Los Angeles, California, the biggest AA group in the whole world, a group that I'm proud to be a member of. Before I forget, I want to thank the committee and Duane for inviting me to come down here this morning and share my life here with you. This is an honor and a privilege, and it's one that I do not take lightly, I can guarantee you. You guys, I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything in the whole world, and I think that it shows. I really think that it shows, and I make an awful lot of mistakes here, and I do an awful lot of things wrong. But I can tell you one thing, goddammit, that I love you. Make no mistake about that. Before I forget, I want to thank Randy, and I want to thank Bly for picking us up at the Kansas City airport and driving us down here. I felt so sorry for Randy, I could have cried for him. He had three chattering women in the car that never shut their mouths for 1 minute. And it really gave him the chance to think about himself, I'm sorry to say. I have had a wonderful, wonderful time this weekend, you guys. I'm home in the Midwest. I love to be here. This has been a great convention, and I'm just as proud as I can be to be at your podium this morning. I really mean that. Anybody in this room is new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you to God's magnificent AA, the program that saved my life, and it's going to save yours too if you're willing to take some real quick actions. And I suggest strongly that you get a sponsor today. I suggest that you get the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that you take it home, and that you do indeed read it, that you become very active here, and you're going to stay sober as I've stayed sober for a little over 8 years. And people like me cannot stay sober, you guys. 8 years is a long time to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's a hell of a long time for me, I can tell you. I've been taught to do a couple things before I ever opened my big mouth in an AA meeting, and one thing is to talk to my sponsor. And I talked to Clancy before he left this morning, and I said, "What do you want me to talk about?" And he just laughed, and he said, "What do I want you to talk about? You get up there and share your experience, your strength, and your hope, and you tell those people what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. You ignore the old-timers who are going to get this program sooner or later without your goddamn inspiration. And you talk to those newcomers who are the life and blood of AA." And I believe that as I stand here this morning. I really do believe that. And I welcome you. And then I think I did the most important thing that I can ever do before I ever open my big mouth in an AA meeting, and that's to say, "God, please help me say what you want me to say to these people. God is very much a part of my life today, you guys. And it did not used to be that way for me, I can guarantee you." You guys, I come from an alcoholic hell that I cannot even describe. It was so bad. And you know, my life is real good today, and sometimes I forget how bad it was. And I'm in the Midwest today, and for some reason, I'm remembering it very vividly today for some reason. It's probably from being around people in Missouri. I don't know. I come from an alcoholic home, and my dad died from alcoholism on the streets of Chicago in 1979. And I come from basically a lovely, lovely home, you guys, and I want you to know that, and my mother wants you to know it, too, I can tell you. I have a very sophisticated, elegant mother that lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. I did not get sober in California. I got sober in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is just a terrible place to get sober, let me tell you. And I was not doing well in Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. I went through 19 sponsors there in rapid succession, and I was not doing real well. And I got sent to Clancy, and as a direct result of that, my life has been nothing but get better. And he always likes me to start with that to show you how wonderful he is. Anyway, you know, I love my father very, very much, you guys, and I want you to know that. In spite of the fact that I came from an alcoholic home, I came from basically a lovely, lovely home. And I love my father more than anything in the whole world, and my dad is dead from this disease today. And I would give anything in the world if my father were alive today, because we would have a lot to talk about, I can guarantee you that. I don't do well with people that stand at AA podiums and blame their mom and dad for the disease, because I'll guarantee you that nobody poured it down me but me. I had every opportunity to do very, very well when I was growing up, and I did totally just the opposite. I was talking to my mom before I flew to Missouri Friday, and she said, "What are you going to do this weekend?" And I said, "Mom, I'm going to go to Columbia, Missouri, and give an AA talk." And you guys, she told me the same thing that she always says to me. She said, "Why do you have to get up there and tell those people all that stuff about yourself? They're not going to like you, you know." I always say, "Mom, the rottener you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more people love you." And she says, "Well, I don't understand that." And I said, "You don't have to understand it." And she said, "And don't tell those people that you're afraid, because they don't like people that are afraid." And I always say, "Mom, the more afraid you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more people love you." And she says, "I don't understand that." And I said, "You don't have to understand it." And then she always tells me this, you guys, and I love to hear it, and I just prod her right into it. She always says, "I'm going to tell you something, young lady. You come from good stock, and we don't air our dirty laundry in public, you know." And I always say, "Mom, it's not dirty anymore," and she doesn't understand that either. But I love my mother very, very much, you guys, and I want you to know that. My mom's very grateful that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but she does not understand our disease, and why would she? She's not an alcoholic. I have a sister who is absolutely gorgeous, you guys. She looks nothing like I do. She was Miss Rah-Rah in high school, and she was homecoming queen. and she was cheerleader and all that kind of crap, and she made straight A's and never cracked the book, and I made straight F's and never cracked the book, and that was the difference. And my sister's a beautiful woman today. She was a model for Neiman Marcus for many, many years in Dallas, Texas, and she just retired here recently, and she's teaching school in the West Indies. And I can tell you that as a direct result of this program that I love my sister very, very much, although I did not feel that way when I was growing up. I was very jealous of her, and I used to look at her and say, oh, who the hell cares, you know. But I did care very, very much. I wanted to be just like her, and I could not be. I have a brother who's a pilot in the Navy in Spain. Neither one of these people are alcoholic. I have another sister who's married to the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, who got me out of one hell of a bunch of trouble when I got sober. And I am welcome in their homes today, and I did not used to be, you guys. And, you know, things with my family are real, real good today. I come from basically a very boring family, if you want to know the truth. And I go for colorful people that get themselves into a lot of trouble. That's what I like. I love the bars. I love the men. I love the sex. I love the music. I love all the crap that goes on in there. I get in there like a glove. And I ran around and I drank with people that were alcoholics, not social drinkers, I can tell you. And I love those people today, and they're so grateful that I'm sober that they can't see straight. And I'm talking about alcoholics. You guys, I have a couple kids, and this is where it really starts getting interesting for me. These kids are a couple of jerks, let me tell you. I love my kids very, very much. Please don't get me wrong, but they are a couple of jerks. And my oldest son's an alcoholic, and he's in Lincoln, Nebraska right now just beating me bejesus out of this disease. And he just got picked up for his number 7th drunk driving charge there in Lincoln, Nebraska, and one more time he's gotten out of it. And I know that I am the last person in the world that can help this kid get sober. I have learned that through many, many painful experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I can do is keep my mouth shut and be an example to him. And he tells me he loves me today, and I can tell you it took a long time for that kid to tell me that. And I will leave the rest of it alone, and I'll pray for him, and maybe one of these days he will find our beautiful program. I have another son, you guys, and he's not an alcoholic, and he's not a drug addict. He's just goofy is what he is. I love to tell this story because it shows you exactly how my life goes. I got a phone call from my son about 2 years ago in Los Angeles, and he said, Mom, I'm getting married tomorrow. And I said, getting married tomorrow? It was a surprise to me that anybody would even have him, if you want to know the truth. And I said, Jeff, why do you call me the day before the wedding and expect me to be back in Nebraska? I said, the Pope's in L.A., and I doubt if I even get a flight out of Los Angeles. And he said, Mom, I don't expect you to be here. It's just going to be a tiny little wedding, and don't worry about coming. And I thought, don't worry about coming. You don't tell people like me that stuff. I wanted to be there, and I couldn't get a flight out of Los Angeles. I was absolutely correct about that. And I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, well, what the hell are you going to do? Walk? If you can't go, you can't go. And I just settled down about it, and I did. And I talked to my mom the day after the wedding, and I said, Mom, how'd the wedding go? And she said, well, it was very lovely, but who was that little girl with him? And I said, what little girl? And she said, well, apparently, Karen, Jeff's got a 4-year-old daughter that you don't know anything about, and I suggest that you call him and talk to him about it. And I can tell you I was more than happy to do that. And I called Nebraska, and I talked to my son, and I said, Jeff, how'd the wedding go? And he said, it was real lovely, Mom. And I said, who was that little girl with you guys? And he said, well, Mom, that's my daughter. And I said, why didn't you tell me that I had a grandbaby? And he said, Mom, I was afraid you'd get drunk. And I thought, get drunk? I wouldn't have gotten drunk over that. At least I don't think I would have, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I can tell you guys, I was on the first thing smoking out of Los Angeles to get home and meet my little granddaughter. And this little girl walked up to me at the airport. And I can tell you guys that she is the icing on the cake to me. She is the apple of my eye. And her name is Brandy. And doesn't that just figure? No. And she came up to me and she said, are you my grandma? And I said, yes, I am. And she said, did you bring me some presents? And I thought, boy, this sounds vaguely familiar. And she says, you know, you're my favorite grandma. And see, that's what I want to hear. That's the stuff I strive for. And I said, well, you don't even know me, Brandy. Why do you say that? And she said, because you wear ribbons in your hair and grandmas don't wear ribbons in their hair. And you're my favorite grandma. And I thought, that's the dumbest thing I had ever heard. But by God, I'll take whatever I can get here. You know, you guys, I flew her out to California last summer to give me a cake at one of my AA birthdays, and I thought she'd be afraid to fly on that airplane by herself in Nebraska, but by God, she wasn't. She got off that plane like she owned it, and I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble because this little girl never shuts her mouth for 2 seconds. And I said, Brandy, do you ever be quiet? And she says, Grandma, I have a lot to say, you know. I said, you sure as hell do. You're giving me a headache. And she said, well, take some aspirin then. You know. But anyway, I love that little girl. I stood at a nursery window, you guys, last January, and I looked at my second grandchild, a little baby boy that was born to my son and his wife. And I can tell you the tears of gratitude rolled down my cheeks because I should not have been standing there. I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska 2 weeks ago and looked at my third grandchild, a little baby boy that was born to that alcoholic kid of mine and his wife. And And one more time, tears of gratitude rolled down my cheeks. And Steve told me, he says, Mom, why are you making such a big deal out of this? Everybody in this place is staring at you. And I said, quite frankly, I could care less who's staring at me. I'll cry if I want to cry, you know. And I put that little baby next to my neck. And I can tell you guys that one more time, tears of gratitude rolled down my cheeks. And I love those kids very, very much. Things are so good with my family today that I cannot even believe it. And it's only a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys, when I was growing up, I was a disruptive jerk is what I was. And I can tell you that I got myself into a lot of trouble when I was a child. When I was a little girl, I was very, very fat. And I weighed about 180 pounds when I was in the seventh grade. And I had two fat friends. And we'd sit around and we'd talk about the boys and how it was going to be for us someday as we ate a loaf of bread, for Christ's sake. You know, and that's about how weird I was. I was very disruptive. I was very, very rebellious. I never felt like I belonged anywhere. And everybody around me seemed to be doing very, very well, and I was just totally the opposite. And you know, when I was growing up, you guys, you know, I would go to school, and I would sit there, and I'd try to study, and I'd be staring out the window, picking my nose, falling in love with the men teachers, looking at the boys, whatever. I never did anything I was supposed to be doing, and I was constantly getting kicked out of those classrooms. And my mom and dad used to say things to me like, why can't you act like the rest of this family? Well, I didn't have any idea why I couldn't. I just couldn't and stuff. And, you know, you guys, I really don't remember my first drink, if you want to know the truth. But I hope to God I never forget my last one. Because I can tell you that the day I got sober, I weighed 95 pounds. I was the color of squash. I had an alcoholic hepatitis. I had a liver cirrhosis. I had ruptured esophageal varices. And if you don't know what that stuff is, you don't want to know what it is. Because that stuff, you die from that stuff. I had just gotten my 18th unit of blood at a hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I found myself dying from alcoholism. I'd lost my nursing license. I'd lost my kids. I'd lost my husband twice, although I didn't really care about that. I'd lost my car. I'd lost everything in my life that I had ever worked for. And I thought to myself, how in the hell did this happen to me? I never once wanted this to happen. I just wanted to have a good time. I was standing on Skid Row, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And if you guys haven't drank Mad Dog, you are not missing a damn thing. That stuff will make you crazier than hell. And I was already there. That Mogan David 2020 is something else. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I had better plans for myself than to be standing here drinking Mad Dog on Skid Row in Lincoln, Nebraska, dying from alcoholism. And I certainly had opportunities to be better than that, I can tell you. And you know, here I was growing up, and I just hated reality. And I'm not much of a reality buff today either, if you want to know the truth. But I'm better today than I have ever been. And you know, I realize that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning, and I identify myself as an alcoholic from this podium. But I'm also a drug addict, too, and I need to make that a small part of my story, and my sponsor encourages me to do that. And there wasn't a lot of drugs on the streets when I was growing up, but I'll guarantee you that I found every single one of them. There was some marijuana, there was some speed and stuff, and you know, today if you get caught for possession of marijuana, you get a ticket. Big deal. When I was growing up, you went to prison is what happened to you. And I was always doing stuff that you weren't supposed to be doing, and I really don't remember my first drink, you guys, but I remember what that first drink did for me. I remember that made me feel like I belonged, and I could be anything I wanted to be, and I could do anything I wanted to do. And from that time on, I drank at any given opportunity, and I was probably about 13 years old when that happened. I'm one of these alcoholic females, and I hate to say this from an AA podium, but it's precisely the way it was for me. That if you pat me on the head, my pants fall off. That's what happens. And I'll guarantee you I got myself into a lot of trouble when I was growing up. I got pregnant when I was 16 years old and I had to get married. And I married an alcoholic, as it must be. And I was 16, he was 17. I couldn't cook, I couldn't clean, I couldn't take care of a baby, nor did I want to take care of a baby. And before we knew, we had two little babies to take care of. And I quick found out what caused all that, and I put a halt to it, I can tell you that. And, you know, I married a man, you guys, and I am not blaming him for my alcoholism, so please don't get me wrong. It's just part of my story, and I need to share it. And I grew to hate this man very, very much. And this guy used to come home and beat the hell out of me on a regular basis, and I literally hated his guts. And he refused to work and stuff. And I found a job as a nurse's aide at a hospital there in Lincoln, Nebraska. And for the first time in my life, I began to respect and admire something, and it's called nursing. And I had that respect and admiration today, too, by the way. And I made a plan to myself. You know, I was working at this hospital as a nurse's aide, and I thought to myself, I would love to become a registered nurse. That's what I would love to do. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have willpower, and I'm here to tell you from this podium this morning that that is just crap. I have more willpower than 20 elephants. When I want to do well, I am going to do well. And I went back and I finished junior high school, and I finished high school, and I went full-time to college for 4 years, and I worked full-time for 4 years. And that is hard stuff to do. And I raised two little boys in the midst of all this, you guys. I got no help from this man whatsoever. And I'm talking about 18, 20 hours a day for four consecutive years. And at the age of 27 years old, I became a registered nurse. And if you think I am proud to stand at this podium this morning and tell you that I got jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and they tell me, you are a disgrace to your profession, you are a disgrace to nursing, and you are a disgrace to medicine. You are no longer working because we just jerked your nursing license. If you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly wrong, let me tell you. You guys, I love my profession. I love the patients that I take care of, and I love the people that I work with. And I cannot say that enough this morning. I would never do anything to jeopardize the people, nor the people that I work with, nor the patients that I take care of. And what I have to tell you today is a story, and it's a love story about how I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a story about how I threw my career and everything in my life that was important to me right down the toilet so I could drink. And that's total insanity is what it is. And anyway, at the age of 27 years old, I became a registered nurse. And I made another plan to myself at that time. I am divorcing this man, and I'm getting the hell out of this marriage. When I was in school, I did not drink, I did not use any drugs, and I did that for a long, long time. I don't have any willpower as far as my disease goes, but I can tell you, when I want to do well, I am going to do well. And I divorced this man. And girls, a whole new world opened up to me when I was 27 years old, and it's called men and alcohol. And let me tell you, I went absolutely crazy. I was engaged 8 times during that divorce from this man. I never did marry these people. 2 of them died from alcoholism, you guys. I did not run around and become engaged to social drinkers. I drank with alcoholics. And we do indeed die from this. And one guy was 42 years old, one guy was 36 years old. And they died from the very same things that I had the day that I got sober. I feel very, very fortunate that I am standing at this podium today. And, you know, I have a couple quick stories to tell you about what my drinking was like. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that we are to tell in a general way what our drinking was like. And you're going to get the general idea real quick. We have a little town in Nebraska, and it's called Palmyra, Nebraska. And I can tell you from personal experience that they take a dim view of naked women walking on their highways. I can tell you that. I've been to a party in Omaha, Nebraska with some nurses that I worked with. And they said, Karen, the party's been over with for a long time. Let's go back to Lincoln. We're all drunk and stuff. And I said, well, run along. I had met 2 guys from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And like I said, you pat me on the head and I'll follow you anywhere. And these guys invited me to a party. And by God, I was going to that party. And I told my friends, run along. If you can't keep up with me, then go back to Lincoln. And that's exactly what they did. And I really can't tell you much about that party nor the people that I was with. All I know is that I woke up out of a blackout on Highway 2 by Palmyra, Nebraska in February. And it's a tad bit nippy in February in Nebraska. And tonight I know why duck's feathers freeze. And I was walking down the highway, stark naked, my high heels carrying my purse. And I thought to myself, what am I going to do? Well, what do? You walk is what you do. And of all the luck, the first person I ran into was a state pig, you know. And in Nebraska, the cops travel by themselves. And this guy stopped his squad car. And he rolled down his window and had his siren on and stuff. And he looked at me and he said, what are you doing? And I thought, well, that's about the dumbest thing I've ever heard anybody say. It's quite obvious what I was doing. And he told me, he said, lady, you get in the squad car and you sit down and don't you touch me. And I looked at this cop and I said, I'm not getting in your squad car. You might try and rape me. And he said, lady, get in the squad car. You know, guys, every time I'm in trouble, I will do one thing more to make it worse every time. And I looked at this guy and I said, I'm not getting in your squad car. And he had to get a matron out from Lincoln, Nebraska City Jail to come out there and get me. And she was not pleased, I'll guarantee you that. They were very busy that night in Lincoln. They did not have time for this foolishness. And I went downtown booked for indecent exposure, for assault and battery, for kicking in his windshield, for hitting him, for hitting her. All the delightful little things that we do as practicing alcoholics. And I'll never forget how humiliating that was to go downtown booked in that cop's raincoat. You know how cops keep raincoats in the trunks of their car for these occasions, I guess. How humiliating that was. And the next morning in that courtroom, when my brother-in-law, the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, who did not know I was in that courtroom, came up to me and he said, Karen, have you lost your marbles or what? Why would anybody do something like this? And I looked at my brother-in-law, and you guys, I will never forget what I told this man, because I was to say this to many, many people in many, many courtrooms. I said, oh, for Christ's sakes, Dennis, this could happen to anybody, you know. And we all know better than that, don't we? And that cost me about $3,000 to get out of it, you guys. And I can tell you, I just shirked it off like it was no big deal. It's just part of life, you know. And I'll never forget what it felt like to wake up in that hospital. You guys, I worked in the operating room for 19 years at Lincoln General Hospital. And I love that job. I love the surgeons. I love the people that I worked with. And I ran around and I drank with medical people mostly. And they were intense, colorful people. And they worked hard and they played hard. And I absolutely love those people today. And I woke up one more time in the emergency room of that hospital that I worked at. And I was always telling ambulance drivers, don't take me to Lincoln General Hospital, take me to a different hospital. They were starting to find out about me over there, and I did not like that, let me tell you. And I was starting to feel the heat from all that. And I woke up one more time, and I'd been to horse races in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I'm one of these alcoholic females. I have a big mouth when I drink, and I have a big mouth when I'm sober, but it's getting better, I can tell you. And I'd smart up to some guy at that horse race track, and he'd pop the hell out of me. And this plastic surgeon was putting 18 stitches in my mouth. And you know, he told me, he said, Karen, we love you so much. You are such a good nurse. Let's send you to a treatment center. Let's get this drinking problem taken care of. And I looked at this surgeon, and I couldn't believe the audacity this man had that he would say something like that to me. And I said, just fix my lip and get the hell out of my face. I'll drink if I want to drink. Denial is the name of the game here, folks. It really is. I know that it was for me. And you know, by this time, you know, I was starting to get in a lot of trouble. The bad checks that we write, I was drinking on a daily basis and stuff. And my kids were starting to get in trouble at home and at school and stuff. And, you know, I hate to say this from a podium, you guys, but I was a rotten mother is what I was. I did not beat my kids, but I can tell you that I emotionally just jammed it right down their throats. And I can tell you the most precious gift I have gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing that my kids will tell me, Mom, we love you. And it took them a long time to say it. And I tell you, it brings me to my knees every time that it happens. And, you know, I thought to myself, I need to get married to their father again. I've been engaged 8 times. I'm getting in trouble here. And all these things are happening. My kids need their father. And, you know, I got to tell you guys, if anybody in this room is thinking about getting married to the same person twice, do not do it. You're going to be sorry. The only way I can describe it is it's like taking a bite out of the same turd twice, if you will. I'm sure he feels the same way I do. And I can tell you guys, I married this man with 2 intentions in my mind. One was to get even with him for all the things that he had done to me. And the second reason was that my kids needed their father. And those are not very good reasons to get married. You're dealing with a very sick person here today, I can tell you. And I'll tell you guys, I danced that man through 3 of the most miserable years of his life on the face of this earth. And it finally got so bad for him, he moved to Sacramento, California to get away from me. But I need to tell you one thing that I did to this man. And I still think it's funny today, if you want to know the truth. And my sponsor tells me that is not funny that you did that. And my sponsor made me go up to him and apologize for what I'd done, too. But anyway, when I married this man again, you guys, I told him, I said, if you ever hit me again, I am going to kill you, and I'm not kidding. And he said, Karen, I'll never hit you again. And I said, you better see that you don't, pal. And anyway, he lied is what he did. And he came home drunk one night, girls, and I was sober that night for some reason. And I'll never know why, but I was sober. I was never sober, but I was that night. And he came home drunk, and girls, you know what guys do when they come home drunk. They want to take you to bed and stuff, and I was not buying it. If there's one thing I cannot stand, it's some drunk man mauling me when I'm sober, you know. Although I will say that when the shoe's on the other foot, though, it's fine with me. And this guy indicated that to me, and I said, you get your hands off me, and you leave me alone. I want nothing to do with him. And he broke my arm. And I'll guarantee you guys that I was pissed, make no mistake about that. And I told this guy, I said, you go to sleep on that couch, buddy, and you are going to wish the hell you had never been born when you wake up. And you guys, he stayed up for hours with his eyes open like this, you know. Is it finally, must be, he passed out. And I started drinking martinis. And this is what alcohol does for me, you guys. Alcohol tells me what to do. I don't tell it what to do. And I had about 8-10 martinis, and the more I drank, the madder I was getting. And I was laying there sitting on the couch watching this guy. And I hate to say this from an AA podium, but if I don't tell you what he was doing, I can't tell the story, and I want to tell the story. He was laying there playing with himself. And I thought, you disgusting man, you make me sick to my stomach. And the more I drank, the madder I got. And I thought to myself, what can I do to get even with this man for all the things that he has done to me? And you know, you guys, I'm a nurse, and I'm very familiar with male anatomy. And I can tell you that I'd be very familiar with male anatomy if I wasn't a nurse. You guys, my kids have just gotten some super glue. And I got that super glue out, and I read the directions on that super glue. And like I said, I was drunk, and I was not seeing very clearly. And what I thought those, and I'm talking about 15, 16 years ago when super glue first came out, and it was powerful stuff, and you did not want to screw around with super glue. And I read the directions, and what I thought those directions said were this. If this hits human skin within 15 hours, you better get it off. Why would it say that? It didn't say that at all. What it said was, if this hits human skin, you better get it off with 5 minutes, is what it said. And I thought about this for a while, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. And I walked over to this man, and I poured super glue all over this guy's groin, and I mean everywhere. There was not one place on this man that did not have super glue. And I laughed about it, and I went to bed. And, you know, I really don't know what I wanted to accomplish there. I just wanted it to tug a little or something. I don't know, but that is not what happened. I did not mean to hurt him as bad as I did. And, And I laughed about it and went to bed. And I woke up in the morning to screams of horror like you cannot even believe. And I'll tell you what happened to my ex-husband. When he was born, he never had the advantage of being circumcised when he was born. And now he was, clearly. And we had a telephone by our bed there in our bedroom there in Lincoln, Nebraska. And he called the police, and the police were out in front of our home with their sirens going. There was an ambulance out there. The neighbors were gawking out the windows. And I remember thinking to myself, I should not have done this. This was really stupid. And the cops were laughing, which led me to believe the whole thing was funny. And they told me, they said, lady, are you crazy or what? Why would anybody do something like this? And I stood there and I looked at those cops and I said, what makes you think that I did it anyway? I was only standing there with glue on my hands, for Christ's sake, you know. And I said, what about my arm that he broke? What about my arm? It was always me, you guys. It was never about anything that I had done to anybody else. And they told me, they said, you're under arrest for assault and battery. And I said, you can't arrest wives in Lincoln, Nebraska for assault and battery against their husbands. I knew better than that. And I guess 2 days later when I got out of jail, I didn't know better than that. And they took him to the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, you guys. And one more time, they saw what Karen Garrison did. It was a very embarrassing situation. And the doctors there in Lincoln could not get that glue off. And they had to get 2 surgeons down from Omaha, Nebraska, from Creighton University Medical School, to get that glue off. And, you know, there was a paper written about that at Creighton University Medical School in Omaha, Nebraska. And I'd always wanted a paper written about me, but not like this, I can tell you. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm getting out of this marriage because when this guy comes home, he is going to glue something to mine shut. And he would have, too, I can tell you that. And I divorced him one more time. And you guys, you know, I just recently sat down and made amends to that man in Sacramento, California. And Clancy made me do it. I wasn't sorry for what I'd done. And Clancy said, I don't care whether you're sorry or not. You get on an airplane, you fly up there and apologize for your behavior. You know, I can tell you that what they say is true in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When we start making amends, things start happening, and this guy kind of backs up when he sees me, but, you know, he sat down and he talked to me, and I told him I was sorry that I had done it, and I was sorry about all the things I had done when I was drinking, and you know, the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous started happening for me when I did that, and I walked away from that man, you guys, and I was free from him, I was free from what I had done to him, and I was free from those 2 marriages, and I felt good, and I started to feel some of that serenity that I hear about here in Alcoholics Anonymous. At that point in my life, you guys, I got involved with the most bizarre man I had ever met before in my entire life. This man told me he was in the mafia in Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, I don't think anybody in Nebraska is in the mafia, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I was lying to him, and he was lying to me, and it was your typical alcoholic nightmare is what it was. And you know, I was really in trouble at work, you guys, by this time. And I was calling in sick, and I was late to work, and I was doing things that I had never done in my career before. And the day came for me when this hospital told me, they said, Karen, we are so tired of reading about you in the paper. We're tired of watching the paper say drunk driving charges, glue in husbands, bad checks, all the stuff that you're doing. Everything in Nebraska that you do is in the paper, you guys, and everybody knows everything about everybody. And they said, you're either going to a treatment center or you are fired. And you guys, you know, you don't tell people like me that stuff. And I said, you and what army's going to make me? And I walked out of a job that I loved more than anything in the whole world. That job was the center core of my very existence. You know, and that's not right. It's more important than my family, my friends. And I know that that's not right, but that's the way it was for me at that time, and I need to share that. And I found a job at a nursing home there in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, last year I was in the operating room, and I had this wonderful job, and here I am in this nursing home, and I'm cleaning up crap, and I hated myself for being there. And if anybody in this room works in a nursing home, I am not knocking nursing homes. Please don't get me wrong. I just need to tell you how I feel about stuff. And anyway, I couldn't even keep that job, you guys, and I was drinking on a daily basis and doing all this stuff. It was something I had to do now, and it was no more fun to be doing any of it, I can tell you. And I'd had about 8 prescriptions for Valium there in Lincoln, Nebraska from Lincoln surgeons, and they found that I was lying to them, and they canceled every one of those prescriptions, and I was in trouble, let me tell you. I either needed to be taking drugs or drinking at any given moment of the day, one or the other, or I'd go into terrible withdrawal and stuff. And I found myself doing some things at that nursing home that I am not proud to discuss from any AA podium in the whole world, let me tell you. I found myself still in drugs at that nursing home, you guys. I was still in Valium and cocaine and Demerol and morphine and anything I could get my hands on. I think that I'm proud of that. You are sadly mistaken. And I hated my own guts so bad I couldn't even look in the mirror. And I would justify it by saying, I'll quit doing it tomorrow. I won't do it anymore. This is the last time I'm going to do it. And we all know that that never happens. We just jump from the fat to the fire here. And it never quit for me. And the day came up for me, when that people that owned that nursing home, they came up to me and they said, Karen, you are such a good nurse, but what is wrong with you? You are just weird is what you are. And I thought to myself, you'd be weird, too, if you had 200 milligrams of Demerol on board. You'd be weird, too. And I threw my narcotic keys at them, and I walked out the door before they fired me. And you guys, I went to work at Bryan Memorial Hospital there in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's a fine, fine facility. And you guys, I was drunk on that interview, and I got that job. And I don't mean I was falling down drunk. I was just maintaining a certain level in my bloodstream that I would not shake and have tremors. And I know there's a lot of people in this room today that can identify with that kind of drinking. And I found myself doing the same things at that hospital that I was doing at that nursing home, stealing drugs. And, you know, and I couldn't even believe it. I just hated myself so bad. And the day came for me when that hospital caught me red-handed stealing some morphine. And I can tell you that had to be the most humiliating day of my entire existence. And they said, you give us your narcotic keys and you get out of here and don't you ever darken this doorstep again. We are reporting this to the State Board of Nursing. And that's exactly what they did. And they should have done it. I would report anybody today in my career that I knew was doing something like that. They did exactly the right things. And I found myself jerked in front of that State Board. And I told you guys what they told me there. And to make a long story real short, you know, that guy kicked me out of his situation. He found out I was lying to him. You know, a typical day for me, you guys, in those years were I would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and withdraw that I can't even begin to tell you how bad it was. And I'd have to gag down vodka to get to the bathroom, to take the Valium, to get to a job that I didn't even have anymore. I was lying about everything that was going on in my life. And I found myself on the streets is what happened to me. My kids were long gone. That man was long gone. And I was in trouble, let me tell you. And you guys, I spent 2 years on the streets, and I've traveled all over the Midwest, and I've been to Kansas City in jail. I've been in detoxes in Kansas City. I've been, you know, to North Dakota, South Dakota, Colorado, all those states, Illinois, Iowa, everywhere, you know, and I've been in detoxes. I've been in nut houses. I've been in hospitals. I've been chained down. I've been strapped down. I cannot think of one single thing that has not happened to me as a practicing female alcoholic out there. And I hated myself so bad I could not even look in the mirror anymore. You know, I have seen and I have done things, you guys, that no woman should ever see or do. And I'm still so sick in the head, I think to myself sometimes, I wouldn't mind seeing some of them again, you know. My sponsor assures me that I'm still a very ill person in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to make a long story short, you know, I was out there, I was prostituting myself. I did anything I had to do to get that alcohol and drugs. And it is not a pleasant existence, I can tell you. There's a chapter in the big book, it's called Desperation Drinking, that describes the kind of drinking that I was doing. My eyes about goggled out of my head when I read it because they were talking about me. And anyway, to make a long story short, you guys, I wound back up there on Skid Row in Nebraska, drinking that Mad Dog, standing there hating my own guts. And I remember that last day of my drinking, I remember that there was a Hilton Hotel that was adjacent to that Skid Row area there in Lincoln. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, last 2 or 3 years ago, I was standing on top of the Hilton Hotel drinking martinis with surgeons. What am I doing standing on Skid Row drinking with these people? And I rather imagine those people felt the same way when they arrived there. And it was so bad. And I really can't tell you much about that day, you guys. All I know is that I woke up, I apparently passed out on the streets. I was taken by ambulance to the very hospital that I was born at, that I worked at for 19 years. And I can tell you guys that the alcoholic hell for me started the day that I got sober. And I can tell you, I woke up in an intensive care ward at Lincoln General Hospital. I had tubes coming out of my belly. I had IVs going. They were force-feeding me. And I was in withdrawal that I can't even begin to tell you how bad it was. And I screamed at those nurses, and I said, you get me some Librium, you get me some Valium, you get me something. This is absolutely inhumane that anybody should have to go through this. And they said, Karen, you need to feel every one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. I went to a fine, fine facility, you guys. They knew exactly what they were doing. They said, there's nothing wrong with your heart. It's not showing any irregularities, and you need to feel all that. We're honest to God afraid that if we give you anything for this withdrawal, that you're going to die from it. And I tell you guys, I hated those people so bad I can't even begin to tell you. But let me tell you what they did for me, you guys. They got me 10 people from Alcoholics Anonymous to come and sit with me. And I'll tell you, I will be forever grateful for this as long as I live. I can tell you that a deep bond was set up with me with this program from the jump, and I'm not kidding. I have people back in my life again. There hadn't been people in my life for a long, long time. I know it sounds very, very childish, but it was a pleasure for me to sit down and have a glass of iced tea with somebody. And I love those people. And they would tell me, they'd say, Karen, just keep breathing. That's all you got to do is breathe. And I'd say, when is this withdrawal going to stop? And they said, when it's time. And I, well, hell, that wasn't good enough for me. I wanted a date is what I wanted. And, you know, they say that most alcohol withdrawal is over with in 3 days, you guys. And maybe it is for some people, but it was not for me. The day I got sober, I was coming off a quart of gin a day and 200 milligrams of Valium a day. And that's a lot of booze and that's a lot of pills. And I had a lot of dying to do. I'm not very big. And I shook and I shook and I died for one solid month, I can tell you. At 30 days of sobriety, I went into that formal treatment program at that hospital. And let me tell you guys what I was like when I was 30 days sober. I needed you so desperately the day that I got sober. But at 30 days of sobriety, it was not like that. I turned on you like you cannot even believe when you started telling me what to do. And I walked into that treatment center, and I felt a little bit better. And there was 14 men in that group therapy session that morning. And they looked at me, and this one guy told me, he said, "You think you're better than everybody else here, don't you?" And I looked at this man, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, what I told this guy. I said, "Yeah, you asshole, and you can put your name at the top of the list, you know." And I can tell you guys, I paid for that comment for a long, long time in that treatment center. I was in an inpatient 30-day program for 7 months, you guys. And that's a long time to be in an inpatient 30-day program. And by this time, I was doing it for the court system. I had $5,000 worth of bad checks to pick up when I got sober. I was $58,000 in debt. I had warrants out for my arrest all over the Midwest. And that judge told me, "You either stay in that treatment center and do what they tell you to do, or you're going to prison is where you're going." And I'll guarantee I stayed in that treatment center, but I hated it. And I went through many, many counselors in that treatment center, probably seven. And I felt like a member of the staff the day that I got out of there, I can tell you. And I completed an inpatient program. I went to an outpatient program. I went to an evening care program. I went to an aftercare program. And I found myself a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I can tell you guys that I was not doing one thing the way that you teach people to do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would tell the newcomers, "You don't need to read that book, and you don't need a sponsor. We do whatever the hell we want to do here. This is an individual program." And I can tell you guys, I was not real popular with the old-timers in Lincoln, Nebraska. And, you know, the old-timers in AA are so precious to me today, I can't even begin to tell you. But at this time in my life, I did not feel that way. And this guy grabbed me out of an AA meeting one day, and this guy was 29 years sober, you guys, and I love this man so much. Every time I go back to Lincoln, I look him up, and we have dinner and stuff, and he looks at me, and he says, "Karen, my God, Clancy has done wonders with you." And I really can't see it, but everybody else can, I guess. And anyway, this guy grabbed me out of an AA meeting, and he said, "We have had all the crap we're going to take off of you, my dear. You stay away from those newcomers. You have nothing to say to the new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't even know what you're talking about." He said, "You have no, don't ever tell these people not to read the book, or they don't need a sponsor. You stay away from the new people." And he said, "Karen, you've been through 19 sponsors here in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we have had it out of you. There's going to be a man from California speaking in Kearney, Nebraska this weekend. His name is Clancy, and you're going to get in the car and go with us Saturday, and you're going to go up and listen to this man speak, and you're going to ask him to be your sponsor." And I looked at this man, I can tell you guys, I looked at him and I said, "Who do you think you are that you're going to tell me who's going to sponsor me?" He said, "Karen, if you don't get in that car and go with us, I'm going to tell everybody in Lincoln, Nebraska how you stole money from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'll guarantee you that I was in that car going to Kearney, Nebraska. By this time, I knew that AA was saving my life, but I didn't like the people, you guys. And I got in that car and I drove to Kearney, Nebraska with these people. And I can tell you guys that from a podium in Kearney, Nebraska, that Clancy literally put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life. And I can tell you guys that my life has never been the same since that talk. And I love this man so very, very much. I can't even begin to tell you. I adore the ground that he walks on. And I can tell you that he does not put up with my crap for one solid second. I know of no human being in the world that I love more than Clancy. And it's a kind of love that I can't even explain, and I don't have to. But anyway, I can tell you that from that podium, that man explained alcoholism. And there was a room of about 2,000 people, and I was the only person in there. And I can tell you that I feel like the only person I wasn't. And I was on the edge of my seat listening to this man. Because let me tell you what was happening for me, you guys. For the first time in my sobriety, I was identifying with another alcoholic. I could identify with his craziness, all the things that he had done. And I wanted this man for a sponsor because I knew that he could help me. And I found myself wanting to go up to Clancy and ask him. And I turned to these people from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I said, "You just remember one thing. This was my idea and not yours." And I walked up to Clancy, and I asked Clancy to be my sponsor. And he looked at me, and as long as I live, I will never forget this as long as I live. He looked at me, and he said, "I don't sponsor crazy people like you." And I thought to myself, why did he say that to me? He doesn't even know me. And I was standing there in my little white gloves on, acting like a little angel, you know. And I didn't know it at the time, but these people had called him 2 weeks prior to him coming to Nebraska and told him all about me. And he said, "Bring her up and I'll talk to her." And he knew all about my game, I can tell you. And he saw right through my crap. And he looked at me and he said, "Karen, I really don't like to sponsor people on long distance basis. But I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to do this for you because if I don't do it, you're probably going to go die somewhere." He said, "But I'm going to tell you something, little girl. You're going to call me every day till I tell you not to call me every day. You are going to read that book. You're going to sponsor people. You're going to do what these old-timers in Lincoln tell you to do. You are not going to argue with me or them or debate with me for one single second. You have become an active, viable member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska, and do what I tell you to do. And if you don't want to do that, you better get yourself a different sponsor." And I looked at this man, you guys, and I can tell you the hair on my neck literally stood up. And I said, yes, sir. And I tell you, I damn near fell over when I said it. Respect's got to start for me somewhere, and it might as well start with my sponsor, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back to Lincoln, Nebraska, and I became very, very active in the right way. And you guys, I wound up by sponsoring 56 people in that town, and I'm not bragging about that. Believe me, it is not that much fun to sponsor 56 people. But I can tell you, those women literally showed me the first 4 years of my sobriety what to do and what not to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love those women today. Every single one of those people are sober. I think that I sponsor the most beautiful women in the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And it's not because of me that they're sober. It's because they're active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the first directions that Clancy told me, he said, Karen, I want you to get that nursing license back. And I tried to tell Clancy, I cannot go through that kind of humiliation. And he said, Karen, are you arguing with me? And I said, no. And he said, get up to the State Board of Nursing and ask those people for your license back. Tell them that you will go to any length to get that license back. And I did it, you guys. And I can tell you that I had to do a lot. You know, those people looked at me and they said, how many lengths are you willing to go to? And I had to take crap off people for 2 years that I wouldn't hire to mow my own lawn, if you want to know the truth. And I had to keep my mouth shut in the process. And I can tell you guys that one of the happiest days of my life occurred about 5 years ago, when one more time I was jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and this time what they told me literally brought me to my knees for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. What they told me was, welcome home, you're fully reinstated as a registered nurse. And I can smell. Let me tell you something, you guys. You did that. I didn't. Believe me, I did the footwork, but you're the ones that got that back for me. And you know, I can tell you, since this is a spiritual meeting this morning, that was my first spiritual orgasm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you, I have not had one before or since it smashed it. And by this time, I was starting to like Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked the people and stuff. And you know, I was talking to Clancy. My life was changing. Things were so good, I couldn't even believe it. And Clancy told me on the phone one day, he said, Karen, where are you at with your spiritual program? And I said, I don't have a spiritual program. I don't believe that stuff. And he said, I want you on your knees in the morning. I want you on your knees at night. And I want you praying for God's will and not yours. And just let's wait and see. Maybe one of these days something will happen for you. And stuff. And you guys, I found myself in a great big huge stadium in Montreal in 1985 at the World Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love to tell this story, and you know, it's just so precious to me. I'm going to tell it at the end of my talk today. And anyway, I flew out to California a couple of times to visit and stuff, and I fell in love with California, AA, and I had to be part of it. And I made a plan to myself. I would love to move to Los Angeles. I would love to work at UCLA in the operating room and be on two of their transplant teams. I want to live in Venice on that crazy Venice beach with all those crazy people. And I wanted this, I wanted that. And I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, Karen, you get those amends made, you get partly out of debt here, and maybe we'll talk about you coming to California. And I guess he didn't know that I had my car packed, you know. And I had to unpack my car and start all over again, and I stayed for another year. And I did what the man asked me to do. And I moved to California about 4.5 years ago, you guys, and I have not been sorry a day since I've done it. I love AA out there. I didn't move to California for anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. And I absolutely love the program that's available to me. But I can tell you that I love AA in the Midwest, too. The people here are so real, I can't even believe it. You guys, my life today is so good, I cannot even begin to tell you how much I love this program. I love this program so deeply that it's hard to even explain it sometimes. And I have a couple quick stories to tell you. And these are stories that I love to tell, and because they show you exactly where I'm at with my sobriety. In 1985, I found myself at a great big stadium in Montreal, and I didn't believe in God, you guys. I couldn't do it and stuff. And I wanted to go to that conference because my sponsor was going to be speaking there, and I made five people that I sponsored from Lincoln, Nebraska drive up there with me. And we found ourselves in a great big stadium, and you know, we went up there with $200 a piece. We couldn't stay in the big hotels. We couldn't afford to. But by God, we were going to that conference. We didn't care if we had to sit outside or sleep outside or whatever. And here we were, and they were down in that football field. And they were practicing for a flag ceremony in that football field. And I will never, ever forget this as long as I live. And I ran down to tell my sponsor hi. And I want to describe this for the new people. I know there's people in this room that have been to the World Conference before. But for the new people, they have people from all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous carrying their national flags. And I know it sounds all real corny, but I can tell you the longer I stay sober, the cornier I get for some reason. And they were down there practicing. And Clancy was down there helping them direct that flag ceremony. And I ran down to tell him hi. And he introduced me to people from all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys. And, you know, I'm from Nebraska, and I was impressed, let me tell you. And I'm impressed today when I meet people from all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ran back up and joined my friends, and that flag ceremony started. And I got to tell you guys, that with the United States of America's flag touched the turf of that stadium. I saw 52,000 people go absolutely crazy. And I looked around myself, and I did not see one dry eye in that stadium. And I remember thinking to myself, God, I wish I could love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as these people do. What is wrong with me? Why can't I love this program? Because they were just crying, tears of joy rolling down their cheeks and stuff. And I remember for the first time, with any amount of sincerity in my life, I said, God, thank you for getting me here. Please help me to stay here. Please help me to love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as these people do. God, I wanted what you guys had, and I was willing at last to go to any lengths to get it that I had to go to. And I can tell you that I got tears in my eyes for the first time in my sobriety that I did not try and stop. And I'll guarantee you that the day I got sober, if you would have put a knife to my neck, I would not have cried. And I can tell you that it felt good, and I cried and I cried and I cried. And I can tell you guys that just for a minute, just for one solid minute, the world stopped for me. And I remembered a woman that was standing on Skid Row in Nebraska that was the color of squash, that was dying from alcoholism. And here she was, 3.5 years sober, in a great big football stadium in Montreal with 52,000 sober people going absolutely crazy. And I can tell you that in a foreign land, in a foreign country, that I came to believe in a power greater than myself by watching the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew there had to be a God, because these people were not capable of pulling off what they had just pulled off in front of my eyes. I knew that God was directing this whole thing. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself. And it's a God that I have talked to every day sincerely since. Because my sponsor has taught me that God and AA have got to be center core of my very existence. Not some damn man, not some job, nothing. It's God and AA. And I am so grateful that that has happened to me. Yeah. I truly believe that the old adage that we see when we're ready to see and we hear when we're ready to hear. And I apparently had done enough and seen enough, and I was ready at that time. You guys, I have one more story to tell you, and this is my most favorite story in the whole world to tell you guys. And I love to tell it because then I get to relive it all over again. I work at UCLA in the operating room. I'm on two of the transplant teams, the heart and liver transplant teams. And I find myself being jetted all over the Western Hemisphere, harvesting organs for UCLA. It's a magnificent job, but it is just a damn job, I can tell you. We have a terrible nursing crisis all over the world right now, and we are working our asses off, let me tell you, and I'm always the first one to complain about it. And I had worked 72 hours this one particular week, and I was tired, you guys, and you know what we're like when we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And my boss called me one night, and I had the night off, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd been to a meeting earlier, and I was exhausted, and I went to bed early. And she said, Karen, I need you to come over here and help me. You guys, my boss is from West Germany, and she makes Clancy look like a pussycat, let me tell you. And she's probably the best nurse I've ever met before in my life, and maybe one of these days when I grow up, I'll be just like her, I don't know. And anyway, she said, Karen, I want you to come over and help me. I know that you're not on call. I know that you're off. I've got 18 people sick tonight. We're going to do a transplant on a little girl that's 3 years old, and I need your help. Now, come on over. And I said, I am not coming to work. I am tired. I am exhausted. I really didn't even think I could even get out of bed. And she hung up on me is what she did. And you guys, you know, my sponsor has taught me to do what's in front of me in this program and not debate it. And that was clearly in front of me. And I was going to call Clancy at 2 o'clock in the morning, but I don't want to talk to him about anything at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I just went to work, and I'm so glad that I did, you guys. And I went walking the hospital, and I sent my orderly upstairs after our patient. We were back in surgery getting that case ready for that little girl. A jet was coming in from the East Coast to deliver for this child, and we had some time to kill and stuff. And he went upstairs, and he brought the little girl down to surgery. And he called me in the back, and he said, Karen, there's so many people with this family that you're not going to believe it. And I thought, well, that's nice that they have the support. I was such a pain in the ass that night. I was just a bitch is what I was. And anyway, I went out front to get my little girl, and the first thing I noticed was the mother. She had the most beautiful blue eyes, you guys, I've ever seen in my entire life, and the father was good-looking, and these parents were in hysterics about their little girl, and there was about 50 people with this family, and I thought, my God, this is really unusual, all these people here at this time of the day with all the, you know, these people, but it's nice that they have the support. And you guys, I looked down at my little patient, and I can tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to love at a level that I never dreamt possible for myself. And I looked into the same beautiful blue eyes. And I can tell you guys that I ever so gently fell in love with this little baby girl. And I can tell you that little girl was so sick she could not even raise her head off the pillow. And she was dying from some strange liver thing and stuff. And her eyes were just so clear blue, I couldn't believe it. And she was hanging on to this little bear. And she had this little bear wrapped up in a blanket. And she was hanging on to him for dear life. And I said, oh, you brought your little bear down to surgery. And she said, She told me her little bear was very, very sick, that her bear was going to have a liver transplant. And I said, oh, you're both going to have one. And she said, no, no, just the bear, you know. And she told me that she had came down with him because he was so scared and stuff. And we sent the mom and dad out the waiting room, and they were just in hysterics, you guys. And the little girl told me, she said, why is my mommy crying? Tell my mommy not to cry. I can't stand it when my mommy's crying. And I said, your mommy's crying because she loves you so much. And anyway, we took the little girl back to surgery, and we put that little girl to sleep. And I can tell you guys that that case did not go well. We almost lost that baby a couple times. But she did, in fact, survive that 16-hour liver transplant. And I can tell you guys that we have a rule at UCLA. You may not get involved with these transplant patients because they want to know where the organs come from, and we cannot tell them. And it's best not to see them. And, you know, just let other people take care of it. And, you know, I don't need to tell anybody in this room that I'm real good at breaking rules, I can tell you. And I became obsessed with this baby, and I had to see her again. And I thought about her for 6 days. And when she was 6 days post-op from that surgery, I thought, I'm just going to go up to her room, and I'm just going to open the door, and I'm not going to talk to anybody. And that's exactly what I did. And I went upstairs, I opened her door, and you guys, I could not believe what was in front of my face. My God, the power of God. Here was this little girl, 6 days post-op from a 16-hour liver transplant. She was jumping up and down in her crib. It was the first time she'd been up since her surgery. Her diapers were hanging around her knees. She had a baby bottle in one hand. She had a little bear in the other arm. And let me tell you what she had done to this bear, you guys. She had put Band-Aids all over this bear. He had Band-Aids on his eyes, his ears, his nose, and I mean everywhere. And she had a blanket wrapped around him. And she was jumping up and down, and her mom had French braided her hair. She had ribbons hanging out of her hair, and she was beautiful is what she was. And her mom and dad were sitting in there with all those people. And, you know, something caught my eye out of the corner of my eye. And I'll be damned if our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, wasn't sitting on this kid's dresser. Now, I'm going to tell you something. If you think I'm going to stay out of that room, you are sadly mistaken. I didn't care if I got fired. And I was in that room like a flash. And I said to the mother, I said, whose book is that? And she said, why, that's my book. Yeah. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so is my husband. Her sponsor was there, his sponsor was there, and those 50 people had driven 500 miles to be with his family, you guys. And they had showed me one more time what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, and it's about love and service. And it was the most magnificent day of my entire existence, I can assure you. And anyway, I said to the mother, I said, how long have you been sober? And she said, I've been sober 5 years today. And I thought, oh, what a great present, her little girl up for the first time from her surgery. And I walked over to the little girl, and she looked at me, and she said, go away, I'm not sick anymore, you know. I had my surgery stuff on, and if I had known I was going to go in that room, I would have changed clothes, and it scared the hell out of her is what it did. And I said, I'm just here just to see how you're doing. And she gave me her little bear, you guys, and told me to take him home and take care of him. And I can tell you guys, I told the mother, I said, I can't take that bear home. My God, this bear went to this kid's liver transplant. You really need to keep it as a memento. And she said, Karen, she's got 50 bears in here, and she wants you to have it. Please take it home. She wants you to have it. And I felt like a fool walking down the hall with that bear. But I can tell you that bear is my most prized possession in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought to myself, my God, the mother's 5 years sober today. What can I give the mother? And I wasn't prepared for a birthday party, you guys. And I remembered something that was in my pocket that Clancy had given me when I was 5 years sober. And it was a medallion for 5 years of sobriety. And, you know, they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have got to give it away to keep it. And I was 7 years sober at this time. And I could not seem to find the person that was special enough, in my opinion, to give my five-year medallion to for my sponsor. And I knew that I had found the person. And I walked over to this woman. And I want to tell you guys the reason I keep that in my pocket is because there are narcotic keys next to that medallion. And I don't need to tell anybody in this room that when I open that narcotic cabinet sometimes at night, that my eyes light up like firecrackers, let me tell you. And I can grab onto that, and I remember where I'm coming from here. And I went over to the mother, and I said, I would like you to have that. And she said, oh, God, I can't take that. And I said, please take it. I want you to have it. And she did. And you guys, I really wanted her to have that. I'm a selfish person, but I really meant that and stuff. And the nurses got wind of all this, and we got a cake for the mother, and we celebrated her 5 years of sobriety. And it was truly a magnificent day. There's been no more contact with that family because it's got to be that way, and they understand that. I understand that little girl is doing very, very well, you guys. And, you know, people ask me all the time. They say, Karen, why do you keep doing all this stuff, giving all these talks, going to all these meetings, sponsoring all these crazy people, doing all the stuff that you do? And I know of no greater thing to say to them that this to the end, that my great blessings may never spoil me, that I may forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And you guys, there's more reasons than that for me. You're the ones that walked with me when nobody else would walk with me. You held my hand when nobody else would hold my hand. And you told me that you loved me. And God damn it, I need you as desperately at this podium this morning as I needed you in 1982. You've taught me how to live. You've taught me how to love. You've taught me how to keep my pants up and all those things. And I can tell you guys that I don't do any of those things very well. But I can tell you the one thing that I do with 200% absolute perfection, and that is this, that I love you more than anything in the whole world. You know, and I can tell you one more thing. It is one hell of a long ways from Skid Row in Nebraska to California to this podium this morning, and I can tell you that I'm as proud as I can be to be up here. Thank you for having me, and thank you for my life.